Hello and welcome to episode 34 of our weekly podcast, Long Shots. And in continuation with how we kicked off season 3, we have another guest this week. But before introducing some general guidelines to our listeners, we are now streaming live on Apple Podcasts, iTunes, Deezer, and a lot of eclectic podcast apps. So I do invite you to subscribe and like our channel so that you get a nice little notification every time an episode goes live. So with that piece of housework behind us, finally, let me first kick off by just saying hi to the usual suspect, Sharad. How's it going, man?
Not much. It's been good. And I look forward to the notification all the time.
Do you wait for the notification?
I wait for the notification. Now that Game of Thrones is done,
yes.
I think the traffic's come back to us.
Yes, the traffic has come back. Hopefully, the audience would still laugh at that joke. Because, we have been out dragging it for 3 weeks straight.
Yeah.
Today I'm very happy because we have a unique guest. It's a person with a completely different profile that we have on one of our podcast episodes. I would like to welcome Kushan Chakraborty. He is a lawyer, a corporate lawyer. He is, I think, number two founder of Cornelia Chambers, which is a Gurgaon-based law firm. Kushan, I'll just give a quick intro before I let him, kick off the conversation. He studied at Christ University in Bangalore, and I actually got in touch with Kushan because there was a time when I think he also wanted to start a podcast. We'll also kick off a bit of conversation on that as we go. He's a corporate advisory and transaction lawyer. He specializes in banking and finance. He's pretty active on Twitter. I can sense that he has fairly vocal political opinions. Unfortunately, we won't be spending too much time on that, but I think that goes for our next good conversation. Welcome, Kushan. How's it going?
It's going very well. Thanks, guys, for having me here. I've been a fan of Transpin for a while now, and I also wait for that notification on Apple Podcasts.
That's good to hear.
Well, as you can see, now we have a third-party validation on the quality of this stuff. I think we have already patted our shoulders enough.
Yeah.
So it's good to get some endorsement. So, Kushan, obviously, you're a lawyer. You've been doing this now for I think a few years. Tell us, like, very basic question. How did you kind of, I remember that there was a time when practicing law was not the, first option in front of a student. Obviously, times have changed since then. I think you guys are getting paid much more than you used to get paid earlier.
It's unregulated, man.
So that probably has a role to play. But, like, yeah. Jokes aside, what exactly were your motivations? How did you enter this field?
Okay, so a little bit of flashback. I come from a very stereotypical middle-class Bengali family where mathematics was the be-all and end-all of my existence. So the first choice that my parents made for me, obviously, was that I should be an engineer. But since I was weak at mathematics, that didn't really work out for me. So the other alternative, an obvious alternative, was for me to be a doctor.
Okay.
So I signed up for...
In the Western context, these are all already very high thresholds.
Yeah.
I'll get doctor.
That's an excellent plan B, by the way.
Yeah, so there was no third option for me. It was either an engineer or to be a doctor. However, I did study for 2 years and I joined one of those coaching classes as well, and I spent my parents' money on that, but I was never interested. So ultimately, I think around class 12, before graduating from school, I opened up to my parents that my interest actually lies in social sciences and the study of law, because that is something that had always interested me. So they asked me to do some research on it, but they were very circumspect about my opinion. The first thing that my mother, I remember, told me was that, are you going to sit with an umbrella outside a court asking people to come in and sign their affidavits or be a notary? Because that's the kind of impression they had of lawyers. So I went and introduced her to a friend of mine. His brother was studying law at the time. So he sort of opened my eyes, and I wanted my mother also to have a conversation with him to understand how lawyers have changed. It's not the lawyers you see on screen anymore. It took a bit of convincing. I believe that my father wasn't convinced till I was in third year of law school, in fact. I wrote two entrance examinations. I didn't get one, which was the National Law School, and I wrote the other one, which was the Scrice, and I got through. I was quite happy to go to Bangalore.
Right.
Great city, yeah?
Great city, absolutely amazing city, and I used to be a rock and metal fan.
Oh, there you go.
So that was a great motivator for me to sort of move to Bangalore. So after 5 years of law school, I managed to become a lawyer, and I think my parents are happy and content now.
Right. But I mean, in terms of like from social sciences, how did you kind of lock on to law as an area? I mean, obviously social sciences itself is a fairly broad domain. Like it was basically when you met lawyers, you thought that, okay, this is something that might be interesting. Like you obviously introduced your mother to a professional who's practicing it. So did your interaction with that person affect your view? Or was it some other driver which came into?
Oh, absolutely. So this person I met was really cool, and the impression and the painting he drew for me about the law, he was a corporate lawyer himself. He didn't argue in courts.
Right.
But he told me about his friends who were arguing in courts, on the kind of matters they were doing, on the kind of matters he was involved in.
Right.
And I spoke with some other people, I did some research online, and I found that lawyers essentially were shaping the way society thought. You know, the politics of the day and the discourse around it. So lawyers were shaping that in courts every day and in transactions every day.
Right.
So I thought that was really interesting, and I wanted to be a part of that to drive the discourse. And essentially, I wanted to be involved in the social structure of India, and I thought this was the most elegant and cool way to achieve that.
Yeah, no, it sounds, even Nikhil, I'm sure, and so do I, we have a lot of lawyer friends, and it's always interesting to hear about matters. And there's a lot of noise in the mainstream newspaper as well on, be it, you know, Chief Justice of India or whatnot. So it's always, you can't really get past some lawyer news. But sort of, how did you get into a startup kind of a mentality? Is startup a correct phrase to look at your own practice? Like, I know typically startups are associated with scale and tech end firms, but you sort of number two in a firm that you guys sort of saw from inception. Is that sort of, how does that change? Like, there's a lot of business development now all of a sudden, correct?
Yeah. So I did spend a fair bit of time in big law. I worked with two big firms before sort of joining this bandwagon of Cornelia Chambers. One big part of being an associate or a lawyer with a big law firm was you're just constantly running short of time. You're putting in 16 to 18 hours a day working.
Right.
And I personally felt that my personal development and the growth of my knowledge as a professional was plateauing. So I was thinking of ways to sort of move aside from that and do something that would really, that would encourage me to go to work every day rather than dreading it. So in fact, my co-founders were also part of the same law firm.
Okay.
And so it was a decision that my co-founder, the brilliant Ritika Kumar, she took, and she also coined the law firm's name.
Right.
And that's how we met. And I was one of the co-founders.
Right.
So like a joint number two.
Right.
So I believe my motivation to start this was personal, to see myself grow as a professional.
I guess it's also a matter, right? If you want to, like some people thrive on being a specialist, like just looking at their domain where the role is very well defined. And you know, you have a set of 10 clients, you cover them methodically. But I think some people like to, you know, kind of experiment and structure things from scratch and look at not just, you know, their own specific profile, but how to grow the business at large. And I guess Cornelia obviously gives you that opportunity.
Right? Oh, absolutely. I have my fingers in several pies right now. Prior to this, I was predominantly a banking and finance lawyer, but now I'm dealing with tech firms and doing litigation matters.
Okay.
Property matters from district courts to high court.
That's
so
awesome.
It's very interesting. Every day seems different, and I'm excited to go to work these days.
That's awesome. Yes.
But you know, like, tell me, Kushan, like, in terms of the value chain of the legal process, right? I mean, I might not be 100% spot on that, but there are some set of guys who actually are in the court, right? Who litigate in person, right? But there are some set of guys who are actually giving them business. Is that, when I was kind of researching this, I kind of realized that there's a difference between counsels who are in court and then partners who are sitting in big law firms who kind of hand them the business. Is that a loose way of kind of looking at it?
So a broad way of looking at it is differentiating between lawyers and advocates.
Correct.
Anyone who appears in court before a judge is an advocate.
Okay.
Whereas anyone who graduates out of law school is a lawyer.
Okay.
So the people you see in corporate law offices running transactions and doing the documentation for them, then lawyers.
Got it.
So they do the documentational part of things. They do the research.
They do everything pre-dispute.
Okay.
Right? And once the dispute is...
But are advocates part of your firm or they actually operate independently?
There are advocates part of my firm as well.
Right.
So since we're a small law firm, we don't have the option of choice. So we do corporate as well as litigation work.
Right.
But sometime in the future, perhaps we'll have that clear firewall and we'll differentiate between the corporate and the litigation sides.
And like, are there advocates who function on a standalone basis? Like they actually get business from many different law firms?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. We'll arrive at the senior counsel point in a while, I'm sure.
Right.
But there are big lawyers who are not senior counsel, but who are retained clients with several law firms. So if you have a matter before, say, the NCLT, the National Company Law Tribunal, so
right.
you approach a particular set of lawyers only. So
yeah.
There are companies and there are
but
law
why
firms.
Why is it so intermediated, if I may ask?
So it has to do with the time spent by a particular advocate before a court.
Okay.
That amount of face time gets you certain weightage before the judge.
Okay.
And so there's the judge at one level and there's the machinery underneath the judge, which is, you know, all the clerks and all the office functions. So it's important to approach a professional for a matter before NCLT or say the DRT or say the TDSAT. Same as if you would approach a particular lawyer for property matters, a particular lawyer for matrimonial matters, etc. So these are specialists in that field.
Right. So I mean, so one's entrenchment within the judicial system actually gives advocates some sort of a standalone position in the entire ecosystem.
Oh, absolutely. And people exploit it to the hilt.
Right.
Just if you go to any court or any tribunal in Delhi, Delhi houses many of those.
Right.
You will see people who've been there for like 20, 25, 30 years, in fact.
Right.
And the kind of muscle they pull, everybody recognizes them, from juniors to judges. And they just need to appear, and some of these people may even wine or dine with the judges,
right.
as controversial as that sounds.
Right.
But they pull a certain kind of weight, so clients feel relieved or relaxed if they go to a client a counsel like that, as opposed
okay.
to a young counsel who's just trying out different forums.
Yeah.
But is there like some sort of a process by which a lawyer can become an advocate? Like, is there something laid out in structure?
As soon as you graduate from law school, you become a lawyer. Now, the Bar Council of India has introduced an All India Bar Examination.
Okay.
I was the first batch of lawyers which wrote the All India Bar Examination.
Right.
The idea was to have a system in place which sort of sifts through most of the lawyers and only retains the best lawyers in the industry. However, that didn't really carry through.
Right.
The exam was mostly a sham, at least the year I wrote. What the Bar Council of India wanted to achieve was to have the same kind of nobility or the same kind of perception as chartered accountants have in India.
Okay.
Right? So once you write the All India Bar Examination and you enroll to the State Bar Council, you are free to appear before any court in India.
Right.
So that's how you become an advocate and you start practicing in courts.
That's interesting. Yeah. And sort of in all different disciplines that you worked in, sort of, you know, you alluded to property and finance and NCLT matters or whatnot. What is sort of close to you at a personal level or which interests you and you actually see there's a lot of scope for reform, if anything?
I would say what particularly interests me and what I find really exciting is litigation.
Mm-hmm.
Because number one, it's so unpredictable, right? It's on a very human scale at how you're interacting with the judge. The judge might be in a bad mood a particular day.
Right.
So you just have to sort of guess at what the judge might be feeling and what the other counsel might be feeling and sort of forward your arguments in that particular way. And on that note, litigation also needs a fair bit of reform because I believe a lot of time is wasted on litigation. So first of all, if you look at just the lawyers, right? There are lawyers in the High Court and Supreme Court who are waiting from 10 to 5.
Yeah.
So that's most of the day just waiting for matters. There are certain matters, say certain lawyers will wait for a matter till 4 o'clock. And then the judge would say, I'm not hearing any other matters today, and the judge's license, right? So that's the entire day wasted. And any litigating lawyer's day starts only at 5. So at the lawyer's level, that is one place where...
But that's a supply-demand issue, right? I guess there are not that many judges.
Correct. Since there's so much pendency, people have to wait.
Right.
The other part is the clients who sort of pay the lawyers to attend matters. So there are procedural appearances and there are effective appearances. And if a matter runs on for like 4 to 5 years, which is the current life cycle of any civil suit in India,
right.
And you're assuming there'd be about 6 to 7 hearings per year. Mm-hmm. So that's about 40 hearings in a matter, and still the matter isn't resolved. And then you go on appeal, and then you go on appeal again to the Supreme Court. So essentially, the simple matter for, say, a money recovery suit is dragged on for 10 to 12 years.
It's right? A lifestyle choice. It's become a lifestyle aspect now, yeah.
It has become a lifestyle, which is why you look at all these clients, they absolutely do not want to go into litigation.
Yeah.
They do not want a dispute to occur. And even if a dispute occurs, they'd rather go into arbitration than to go to courts.
Right.
Which is why there's so much emphasis on corporate lawyers to make a foolproof contract so that disputes never occur.
Right. But I mean, is it, like, if I kind of just step back a moment when you mentioned that like there's a lot of pendency because of which, you know, there's a lot of, basically there are efficiency losses, right?
That's right.
Now, the pendency reasons might be obviously there's a shortage of judges. But doesn't like judicial activism also has a role to play? Like, I sometimes find it very interesting that, okay, how come BCCI is coming under the scope of Supreme Court? Like, how come, like, so, like, civil issues are fine, right? I mean, they obviously have their place in the overall judicial system. But, like, why is it that so many issues which are, you know, which should technically be under the domain of the legislature because of legislative vacuum, or because of even proactive push from the judiciary, kind of fall under the Supreme Court's domain? I mean, there are often matters which have been resolved, they are again appealed, even though they have been resolved technically, quote unquote, by the highest court in the land. So that also has kind of taken us into a soup, right, effectively.
Oh, absolutely. The question of judicial overreach has been plaguing us for a while now. And one of the reasons that I personally can think of is that the judiciary doesn't consider any other arms of the state, the executive and the bureaucracy, to be any good. The common belief is that there's a lot of corruption there, and the judiciary assumes that it is the only body in which the public can still retain its trust.
Right.
So if there are, say, crores of people who are affected by the way BCCI is operating, so the judiciary takes it upon itself to sort of correct that. Although strictly speaking, it is not the judiciary's role to do that. That's a clear case of overreach. But in my assumption, that's because the judiciary considers that it is the only body, it is the only watchdog which can sort of correct things for people in India, and people can't really expect that of their governments.
I mean, even the government sometimes just wash their hands off, and right, and kind of they just kind of park the area to be taken care of by the judiciary.
Of course. And since the government is the biggest litigant in India, I mean, anywhere between 50 to 70% of matters before all courts in India are the government's.
Right.
So judges see this day in and day out, how the government is just lax in conducting their affairs. And so I think that's one of the reasons why.
I think nothing like government bashing during election season. Right?
Yeah. this is right in the middle of it.
This is the appropriate time to do that. But you know, like, we kind of briefly touched upon the point of senior counsels, right? I mean, I know that's a fairly, I would say, controversial area. It's one of those, it's like the elephant in the room, everybody knows about it, but not many people talk about it, right? I was reading somewhere that, you know, India has 1.2 million lawyers, which is pretty much in line with what US has. But it's bizarre because while we are over-lawyered at one end of the spectrum, we are under-lawyered at the other end of the spectrum. And that's one of the principal reasons why senior advocates can, you know, kind of charge lakhs and lakhs of rupees of fees for just
an appearance,
you know, looking at documents, or for, you know, giving some sort of a minimum amount of time. And like, I come from the UK, right? I mean, I've actually seen the financial crisis hit in post 2008, like how banker bonuses were so much scrutinized, were so much looked into by the mainstream media. Whereas I sometimes feel that, you know, in the Indian context, if you look at senior advocates, they have a complete free reign, right? I mean, nobody even talks about that, right? I mean, What are your high level thoughts on that?
Okay, so law is one area which is largely recession proof, especially litigation for that matter, because regardless of whatever happens in the market, you're always going to have cases in courts. So the Advocates Act, which regulates the conduct of lawyers, defines advocates as senior advocates and other advocates. I am one of the other advocates, so take whatever I say with a pinch of salt. So what largely happens is, senior advocates are considered to be eminent jurists who know the law.
Yeah.
And once you are designated as senior counsel, which can be basis your experience in the High Court or the Supreme Court, or if you basis your seniority. So once you become a senior lawyer, you Number one, are not expected to draft pleadings. Number two, not expected to meet or solicit clients.
Okay.
So your interaction is solely with the court and to guide the court towards justice, right? So there's a larger purpose, there's a loftier purpose here. So senior counsel, because of their expertise and because of the time they've put in, their experience before particular judges and particular courts, they command a sort of indulgence by the court, so to speak. So they get to charge whatever they feel because they know that they're a rare commodity. Right, so if you go to buy a Lamborghini, it commands the price it commands because it's probably one of the few vehicles which will give you what you need. Right, so senior counsels act the same way. So there are a fair few senior counsels in the Supreme Court and the High Courts. So these guys practically rule the roost when it comes to big matters.
Yeah,
but I feel that the purpose of giving access to justice to common people is being lost somewhere there, and that most people will not be able to afford the senior counsel. Even when we have matters, we have contentious matters before the Supreme Court and High Court, the clients will sometimes tell us that, you know, it matters a lot to them, but they just don't have the money for us to pay for senior counsel. So they'll say, can we ask someone who is maybe not a senior counsel, but also has the experience?
So what do you think the middle ground is? Like, capping salaries, capping or designating a specific amount of time to matters which are sort of, you know, cannot be charged at a rate that you, status quo rate, or, because at the end of the day, we're talking about regulation versus deregulation, right? At the end of the day, sort of, you know, I personally sort of have a capitalistic mindset in terms of, you know, free markets and deregulation, and supply demand has a funny way of matching itself. And if the lawyer is, advocate is commanding a certain price, it's because there is a market for it. I get the side effects of it and I'm cognizant of it, and we've seen examples in the West as well, right? There is, capitalism has its evil byproduct. But what is the solution here? Sort of, do you regulate? Like, do you adjust for pricing? Like, what do you think works?
Okay, so I'm not really sure if capping is the right, capping of fees is the right way to go about it, because the lawyers know that what a particular matter means to the client, so they are going to charge it regardless. Even if they don't charge it in fees, then they might charge it in non-cash ways. One of the ways in which you can ensure that senior counsels, senior advocates do end up doing what they were designated to do is to have a cap on the number of matters they can do.
Okay.
So say they are bound to take up at least 12 pro bono matters a year. You know, and this is over and above whatever commercial matters they're taking. So that is one way to ensure that senior counsel actually do help people, the marginalized and the oppressed people who actually do need their services more than the others. So that is one way of looking at it. There are other examples, for instance, in the UK where people follow this mode of a counsel handling only one matter at a time.
Okay.
Right. So you see the matter through to its completion, and during that time, all your attention is toward that one matter, whether it be pro bono or whether it be a for professional fees. So that is one way of ensuring that the lawyer devotes all his energies to one particular matter only, and senior counsels, I believe, can be regulated in that way.
But is there a rate defined, like in terms of X per hour? Is there some sort of a, I mean, there has to be, no? I mean, okay, I mean, at the end of the day, even if I take, let's say I only take one matter at a time, right? I can, if I don't have some sort of cap, I can take, and I know that I have that kind of a clout in the overall ecosystem, I can charge whatever I want, right? I mean, if I find that a bit odd, I don't know. I mean,
of course, it is odd, and council are free to sort of market and to rate themselves as they please. So there are certain senior counsels who will charge, say, 5 lakhs for even a conference, for a briefing. And there are others who may not charge anything, who will only charge for appearances.
Right.
So it is completely on their discretion, and clients pay because they need it. But there is no statute, there is no regulation.
I guess because there's no benchmark as well, right? In a way.
No. I mean, there is no benchmark.
Because typically, like, if suppose you're a consultant or a banker, you know, you're typically, I mean, that's the way it is, right? You'll typically see, okay, if you're JPM, okay, what does other American banks charging on the street? And you have to kind of match it, right? You cannot really go beyond it in a certain way. So is that basically the middle ground that probably needs to be included? Is that even possible, you think? Maybe, like, if you look, I mean, one issue might be that because there are insufficient number of reference points, that creates a challenge. And are, like, entry of foreign law firms, maybe, you know, more guys who are doing the same thing, do you think that will play a role?
Of course, that could play a role in the market dynamics at play. However, I don't feel That is going to happen anytime soon.
Right.
And because see, there are a lot of actors at play here, and the guys who are benefiting from the system will try their best to sort of not to maintain status quo. So even though crores are spent on bar council elections and bar association elections, there is not a word that is being said about senior council fees or capping senior council fees at all. So of course, market regulation is one way of looking at it, but I'm not really sure how practical that would be or how it might play out.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. But you know, in terms of entry of like, I was kind of just getting a sense that like post 91, practically every second sector has been liberalized. You know, I mean, you have foreign players coming in. Legal services is one of those areas which is still pretty operates in a silo. I do know that there are obviously, special economic zones or areas, you know, which are kind of where foreign law firms can operate. And I also kind of am familiar with the fact that a lot of foreign law firms basically just like moonlight, they come over, they provide advisory.
It's called fly in, fly out.
Fly in, fly out,
yeah,
moonlight,
yeah.
Fly in,
yeah.
Fly in, fly out is probably a better way to put it. But if a big company, if a big UK-based law firm or a US-based law firm is allowed to operate openly in the country, why hasn't it happened? Is it because the domestics are lobbying against it? Obviously, that might be a factor, but like, what exactly is going on there?
Well, that is absolutely a factor. Number one, there's a great lobby against allowing foreign firms to participate in India and especially to appear in courts. So one is the lobby, and I'll get to that in a bit. The second part is the reciprocation, in that if Indian lawyers, if I wanted to go practice in England or in Australia or in the US, I'd have to write the bar exam.
Yeah.
And in the US, I'd have to write the bar exam for the particular state where I want to where I want to practice.
Okay.
So if they don't clear that exam for us, then there's no reciprocation here, and they get a higher sort of leeway. So that's another factor.
Okay.
But going quickly back to the lobbying part, so the Advocates Act doesn't allow lawyers not qualified under Indian law and not registered with the Bar Association to practice in India.
Okay.
So since that applies to Indian lawyers, it should apply to foreign lawyers as well. That was the contention that was taken in one of the landmark cases on this matter. But what has happened essentially is post-1991, since the Indian economy was liberalized, foreign law firms were allowed to open liaison offices by the RBI.
Okay.
But there were petitions before the Bombay High Court and I think the Madras High Court, which said that the RBI had essentially made an error in allowing foreign law firms to open liaison offices and for them to allow foreign law firms to advise under Indian law, right? So there was this great push from the judiciary and from the bar that foreign lawyers should not be allowed because that would end up...
When you say foreign lawyers, they're basically like foreign
licensed
law firm employed lawyers but who have a license to practice in India, right? That still doesn't change, right?
So what had happened earlier was they were not licensed to practice in India.
Okay.
But they were foreign qualified lawyers. So
okay.
They were maybe registered with the New York Bar or in England and Wales. But they were practicing and advising on Indian laws. But foreign lawyers could be part of law firms or could be individuals also.
Okay.
So the entire push was to sort of push foreigners out and retain the field only for Indians.
That sounds awfully familiar to something that's happened in the past.
Nicely put, my friend.
No, it's interesting. I mean, I understand the reciprocal arrangement, if you will. I mean, that sounds fair. But in terms of sort of on one end, when we're talking about not regulating fees, then I also think that you got to not regulate market forces, right? If someone else wants to come in, I mean, yes, there is a level of protectionism, but I like to see both of them in conjunction. So when I say I have a capitalistic mindset, it's not sort of saying that charge whatever you want, but if you're doing, you can't have both sides, right? You got to...
We have the Competition Act in force now. We have
yeah.
the Competition Commission. We are aware that more competition will only improve things for the end consumer. Why are we not having it for the legal field? I think there's extensive lobbying on this. And there are a lot of vested interest people who don't want because I think they just have to pack up their businesses and move out.
Yeah.
But do you think there will be a big disruption if suppose tomorrow all like foreign law firms are allowed? Like in terms of actual proposition, in terms of services, do you think there's a big...
At least not initially. It's going to take some time to settle in.
Right.
But who will be most affected by this are the big law firms.
Mm-hmm.
Say the top five law firms and the senior counsels, right? So if if they start facing competition, then they don't get to demand the fees that they demand right now. So it will start at that level, and then it will start percolating down, because you then get foreign smaller law firms also. There are law firms in China which have like 5,000 to 10,000 lawyers. So if they can deploy these kind of resources, which Indian firms can't, I think the market can be usurped completely.
Okay. But like that kind of brings us, you know, like obviously, as you mentioned, that due to these, you know, high litigation costs, access, a lot of people now prefer alternate dispute mechanisms, you know, like arbitration. Like, but I mean, arbitration obviously goes closely with the ability to enforce agreements, right, out of court or whatever, for the lack of a better word. Where do you think we stand there in terms of, like, do you think that when you're dealing with clients, there are sufficient arbitration mechanisms in place which actually leads to a decent settlement? Or there are big gaps that you see there as well?
See, arbitration in and of itself is a great goal to strive for. People do opt for arbitration because, number one, they do not want to go to courts. Number two, they get to decide the procedure amongst themselves. They get to decide the arbitrator, etc. But ultimately, what ends up happening is, after the arbitral award is made, you still end up going to court, and one of the parties ends up challenging it. So the entire process is just elongated by another 12 or 15 months.
It defeats the entire purpose then.
It defeats the entire purpose. So what India is moving towards, and this is especially true for big businesses, is they have something called institutional arbitration. So they go to like a Singapore International Arbitration Court, or they go to ICC, International Chambers of Commerce, or they're arbitrated in London, which have certain rules in place and which are less open to challenges, in that the order will be well-reasoned, it won't be against public policy. So even when you bring it to challenge, you won't have enough grounds. So that is number one. Number two, in terms of enforcement of contracts, I believe there are certain judges in India, and this is true of metropolitan courts. What I mean by that is, if you look at courts in Delhi, Bombay, Chennai, Bangalore, there are certain judges who understand contract, who keep pace with the developments in the industry. But most other judges absolutely do not. We have matters before Gurgaon courts where we take abundant precaution and we draft our pleadings in a way that judges do understand. So we really have to dumb it down. I should probably be apologizing for using this language, but we have to dumb
don't
it
worry,
down.
This is only between us.
But in order for judges to understand and keep up, because otherwise what ends up happening is, if the judge doesn't understand, he's not going to pass orders.
Yeah.
So we're going to have to wait for another judge to substitute this judge and then explain the whole thing again. So ad nauseum, and then, you know, it doesn't really help anyone.
We need AI judges, man. Adjust for all these factors.
That is something that has been considered.
Oh, really?
I think it's in effect in US.
Where, oh, really?
Where artificial intelligence helps judges decide matters.
Right.
Yeah.
So that is something which is on the table.
Yeah, I did not know that. So, yeah, because you also said that you have to play to the mood of the judge and things like that.
Absolutely.
One way to adjust for all of that, remove a person, just add a machine.
So one of the core skills a lawyer can have is to understand how a judge will react to a particular matter. So they will say, we'll file this matter only before this judge and only at this particular time, you know. So as far as they can manage it, they try and fix it, because it becomes more predictable for them.
But you know, amongst judges, are they like, I mean, I guess judges are kind of generalists, right? But often a lot of the corporate matters, you know, be it from very specific sectors like telecom, or they're fairly technical matters to start with, right? Do you think the judges are equipped to, do they have sectoral expertise, or do they have guys who can support them with that? Or do you think, or in the medium term, do you actually see judges specialize in specific domains, that, you know, we only hear matters related to this industry? Does that also happen in the industry?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. So if you go to a high court or a sessions court or a district court, you won't find specialized judges. But if you go to a tribunal, say something like Securities Appellate Tribunal, if you go to the Competition Commission, the judges and the bench sitting there is actually sort of equipped, I would say. I don't say they're completely equipped, but they are more equipped than, say, a regular judge would be to deal with matters like this. And a lot of these tribunals have retired High Court judges, like the National Green Tribunal will have judges, retired judges of the Supreme Court, who would come and they would have a sole focus around pollution and environmental laws.
Right.
So these judges would have dealt with these matters in the past, but once they sit on the tribunal, they deal only with matters like this,
right,
and they read and they attend conferences. So I think they're trying to sort of keep pace with the market.
Right.
And sort of, I'm making a pivot here, but I remember when I came back after being sort of 8 years away from India, when I came back, I think it was late 2017, and one of the news that came at that time was sort of impeachment proceedings, and there was a whole council, and, you know, Deepak Mishra, I think, was it correct? Was it Deepak Mishra that time, the Chief Justice of India?
Yeah, it was a little bit of
yeah, and I, for, that's a big deal, right? And I came in, and I'm like, what is happening? But there have been a few more scandals, and recently as well, right?
Yeah.
They're in the news, like, for, let's call it the wrong reasons. What sort of what are your views on that in terms of tarnishing the image? Because sort of I come from a mindset that whatever happens, you can't go wrong. Like courts and Supreme Court, like they're the, if that falls off, then the nation breaks up. Like that is the ultimate end of all fort that needs to be held, right? So what sort of, do you think it's being questioned, or these are all very human, like at the end of the day, they're humans, right? Emotions come in and mistakes are made. Or is that something not to be worried about? Or like, is there any view on that?
Okay, so if I'm assuming you're the common man here. So if the common man feels like that, lawyers feel that 2x, right? So when I joined the bar, I had great respect for the judiciary. I can still say I have great respect for the judiciary, but it's been tarnished a bit because of my experience spent at the bar. So when instances like this crop up and it comes to public attention, when we hear news about the Chief Justice of India, the supreme legal authority in India, being embroiled in a matter like this, of course it tarnishes the image and it sort of impacts the faith people have in the judiciary. They are humans, of course. I mean, people make mistakes, but not of this nature. People would assume that, you know, there are certain offenses which can be termed human error, and there are certain offenses which can't.
Yeah.
And even so, since you hold a constitutional position, perhaps there are certain measures that you can take. Perhaps you could demit office to sort of help restore that faith people have in the judiciary. So of course, and since media is abuzz with news, and that might especially be because it's election season.
Right.
So media is abuzz with stories like this, and they're sort of amplifying the noise around this. I don't really know, and I don't want to comment on the veracity of the allegations in this matter. But the bar and the bench will be watching this matter.
I mean, to be fair, in this particular matter, I think this scandal was not the content of the allegation. The scandal was how, what process was followed after that. Correct.
Yeah.
I mean, and there are, I mean, there are precedents, right, which have already been set. If such kind of issues come in, that, you know, you have to look at like who are the senior most female judge, who should, you know, like, I mean, there are other precedent cases. I guess it's always the question of who will police the top cop.
Exactly.
Right, and that's where it kind of falls on. And I think it's not even a particularly India-centric issue.
Yeah, no, I agree.
I mean,
yeah.
To be fair, I mean, the US Supreme Court, very emotional testimony. You know, we all got affected by it or whatever.
Yeah.
But in the end, it pretty much happened in line with what the...
Yeah, and that's why sort of I was alluding to, like, at the end of the day, human beings, the things will happen. But we've seen our share of courtroom drama this year, like India and US. I mean, the two markets that I think we closely follow from our standpoint. There have been some lawyer-heavy and confessions and scandals and whatnot, right?
Yeah.
Another thing I wanted to ask, sort of this again, I'm going all over the place, but in terms of, we talked about fees and what... Also, like, I feel like there's a massive discrepancy between what a top lawyer makes and what a junior fresh out of school makes. Like, I didn't see that discrepancy in the West, be it a lawyer, be it a banker. Like, of course, the CEO or the top guy makes a lot more. But the ratio, I feel, is like massive here.
Yeah.
Like, a fresh out of school, even if from a well-reputed school, if for whatever it's worth, the ratio, it seems like there's a big discrepancy. Is that... do you think that needs to be addressed as well, or do you think, you know what, like, it's survival of the fittest?
It absolutely needs to be addressed. So again, I'll go back to the difference between, say, advocates and lawyers. So, so fresh out of law school, if a candidate joins a corporate law firm, so I think the seven biggest law firms in India will offer freshers a five-figure salary, which is pretty neat for a 22, 23-year-old person.
Yeah.
However, if she chooses to decide to join the bar, and work under a senior, there is this concept which comes into play called bedeviling.
Okay.
Right? So bedeviling is essentially, you should not be asking for any fees.
Interesting
term. The fact that you're getting any fees at all is a luxury. Right?
So it's investment into future.
Exactly. And you're learning from the best in the biz for free. So that's a luxury. Right?
This is a formal concept?
No, it's not formal, but it's an open secret. So, there are lawyers who don't pay their juniors at all.
Right.
I know a few very famous senior counsel who didn't pay their juniors for a good two and a half years. without any thought of how that person was managing his or her affairs. And suddenly one day decided to just give like 5 lakh rupees out of nowhere.
Okay.
So he was one of the my friend was one of the lucky ones who got that money. But there are several others who don't get any sort of money for working seniors.
But does it make it like, I mean, then attracting talent is also a challenge.
Exactly.
I mean,
and it's not even sustainable, this model.
It's absolutely not sustainable. So if you have like a godfather or your parents are really invested in this business, then sure, they'll help you sustain through these the initial 5-6 years.
Right.
But most people do not end up having that. And what's happened since a lot of new law schools have opened, there are a lot of first generation lawyers, myself included. So my first job was litigation, but I was lucky enough to join a big law firm. So I had some sort of salary, but what happens in most of these chambers, these independent advocates, is that you end up joining and a graduate of a law school ends up making less money than the court clerk, who might be a class 12 pass out, if
right.
So there's an obvious discrepancy there, and I think how you could move to address it is, number one, the Bar Association should give more opportunities to juniors to sort of attend other matters and get some money through legal aid camps. Or other means, or they should have some sort of a minimum threshold that this is the bare minimum that every lawyer should give them.
Yeah.
Because that narrative of sort of when you're young, just work, when you work your butt off and, you know, it pays off. That's sort of there in the West, in the banking world as well. As a junior analyst, you just work for insane hours, like 100-hour weeks are not exception. They're sort of status quo, right? I mean, Nikhil can obviously endorse to that as well. And you're paid well, though.
Yeah.
You're compensated well.
I mean,
on the
entry
average
level, then you're one of the most well-paid person as well.
Yes,
I mean,
yes, you are. Like, across the board, right?
Yeah.
For the 100 hours a week that you're investing, yes, you're learning a lot, but there is a tangible benefit also in terms of money.
Yeah.
And that's why sort of what Nikhil is saying, I agree that it attracts top talent because of that two-pronged
approach. Those industries are now kind of facing the
challenge.
In spite of actually, because I mean, then there's a cultural issue, right?
Which
kind of comes in because now people compare it to tech.
And tech has caught up now with that pay scale. So it's become different now. But I've never heard of anyone saying that you're not paid and paying is like getting paid is a luxury because you should entirely be, that's new to me. It's crazy.
Yeah, but lawyers would still graduate would still join these law firms and work their behinds off in district courts and high courts and supreme courts because I think a lot of them are looking at the long game.
Yeah.
Right. A corporate lawyer, a partner at a law firm, is never going to make enough as much money as a top litigator is. Right.
Yeah.
So I think that is what they've set their eyes on.
Yeah, I mean, but only a small slice of people can actually afford to do that, right?
Absolutely.
I mean, I guess if someone is compelled to be a breadwinner, I mean, to be very fair, I mean, I think if you look at Indian pay scales in general, I think people are not financially independent till they're 25, 26.
Yeah.
I mean, that's an industry-wide problem.
That's a point.
I mean, if you're a 22-year-old and you want to, like, you know, live on an entry-level salary and rent an apartment in a, like, city
metro,
metro, I mean, it's very, very difficult.
Agreed,
to, you know,
yeah.
You hardly save anything.
And it's one of the reasons why the public also perceives lawyers in the light that they perceive it because even when I was considering law as a profession, my parents told me that, you know, lawyers don't make enough money.
Yeah.
Like, they have to wait outside courts for clients. Is that what you see yourself doing? But I knew of a different world which my parents weren't aware of.
Right.
But there are still lawyers who have to do that to be able to survive, just to ensure the bare minimum, right?
Yeah.
So unless you maintain that sort of quality, that sort of threshold in payment,
you
will not get a lot of good quality lawyers. You will get it in Delhi, but will you get good quality lawyers in Meerut and Muzaffarpur and rural parts where people really need good lawyers?
Right, absolutely. Absolutely.
And another thing, I have a lot of respect for lawyers, but I mean, this is just anecdotal, but I have, you know, very close friends are lawyers and they have this knack of using, I think, a similar, very logical framework, even in their personal lives. And you always see that. And I used to always debate with my friends in Canada on, you know, who do you think will make a better prime minister or a president, a lawyer or a banker or a businessman?
Mm-hmm.
And we used to sort of argue, and this is all, I mean, then came Mr. Trump, but I'm talking about before that. And we used to say that a businessman and a lawyer, like they both are analytical, they both know how to, you know, do things, but a businessman knows how to run a business, which should be synonymous to running a country, although very different things, but managing an entity. And we are saying a lawyer advises other people how to run a business or maybe steps in. So a businessman should be better, but then you look at an example of Barack Obama and Donald Trump, and then, like, then we're like, okay, we've said back-to-back presidents, one's a businessman, one's a lawyer, and I think...
Why is that?
I I don't know what to make out of that. Yeah. I mean, Barack Obama, obviously, legit lawyer.
Yeah.
Trump, legit businessman. No,
it's not a like for like.
What about someone like Macron?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think now that we have kind of established a mix of grim as well as positive outlook towards the legal field, thanks to our in-house guest today. I think next is something that is pretty close to your heart based on your political stance, the ease of doing business rankings.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I'm pretty sure that you're very satisfied with the present government's performance in that realm. Sarcasm, right? Anyways, I mean, even if you look at that as a framework, you know, there are two things there, right? If you look at ease of doing business, there's one particular field, enforcement of contracts, right? Where in spite of India getting a 77 rank on overall basis, we are still stagnant there, right? When you look at like disputes, where do you see the biggest gap? Where what are the common causes why contracts are not enforced? I'll give you a very small homegrown example here. Like we tried to hire, like, I mean, now we have been around 2 years old. So our first hire was a tech hire, mm-hmm. and it took us 3 months to get that person. That guy signed everything and he didn't show up, and I didn't know what to do.
Yeah,
I mean, it's a very small example, mm-hmm. but this happened to me after spending 5 years in a country where if you sign a piece of paper,
yeah.
it's almost like it's sacred.
Yeah.
You know, you don't.
It's worth something.
Yeah. It's worth something. And that then I realized, okay, this is not really the case here. That was just my very small experience. But how do you see this entire problem, and how, in spite of such a massive organized push on EODB rankings by the Modi government, this is still a bit of a puzzle?
Oh, absolutely. So I think this is a cultural sort of feeling in India, in that sanctity is not granted to contracts on a signed piece of paper. And that's because people don't really consider matters to go to courts, because people are very reluctant to sort of handle disputes. And even if matters go to courts, people believe that they sort of find a way out and then they just settle the dispute or whatever. So you'd be surprised how many matters I get, just simple contracts, all these recovery suits that I appear for, is just you provided a service and the person refuses to pay, right? There's this mentality of what are you going to do,
right?
So can you possibly go to court?
The cost of going to court will be higher than the cost of the transaction.
Exactly. So is that an opportunity cost you're willing to bear?
Right.
So most people aren't, and they look at lawyers as this like if this is a Lord of the Ring reference, there's a ring rates, right? So who are servants of the Dark Lord?
Right.
So they look at lawyers like that, and it's like an ominous thing if you invite lawyers to a business meeting or to settle a contract, right? So that is definitely one aspect, and people don't respect contracts as much in India, and that's predominantly because of the way judicial system treats it, right? Mm-hmm. If a single contract, like your techie for example, if you take that techie to court, that matter is going to take you 7 years, and the judge is not even going to respect. Judge is not even going to respect your opinion on the matter.
Right.
So I mean, people don't have that much faith in lawyers and in the legal system. So that's one of the great factors why people don't want to do business with India.
Yeah,
right?
And it's a big ship to turn, right? Like it needs time and effort. Like it's going to take to create or change that fundamental notion. It'll take a lot of time.
We're
right?
definitely moving in that direction, though.
Okay.
I mean, the new generation of entrepreneurs, people in my generation, people in your generation, I think they're the same generation.
So
we do give that sanctity to contracts, but a lot of us still don't. And there needs to be sort of a cultural turnaround on this, and to ensure that contracts are honored and in time. Right? That's
I guess it's a question of a promise of a consequence, right? If you don't, I mean, that has to be uncontested.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not like when in the Western context, it's not like you expect a lawsuit, but you know that a lawsuit can come, right?
So, and if it comes, then there'll be a proper storm, right?
Right.
And you can't weather that storm unless you're like a big wig. In India, unfortunately, that's not how it goes.
Right. Right. But another parameter where I think the ease of doing business ranking performed very well was bankruptcies, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, now I think yesterday or 2 days back was the 3rd year anniversary of the IBC,
yeah.
right? Now, IBC, I mean, I was kind of fortunate enough to be here when those initial, movements started happening.
2016, right?
Yeah. So, I mean, what's your overall view? I mean, obviously, a lot of things have happened in the last, 24 to 36 months. Big names. Be it SR, be it Bhushan, promoters have actually lost control, new buyers have come in, taken those assets over. RBI has cracked the whip, right? And I mean, they took a fairly systemic approach in doing that, like targeting the top 50% of all NPAs. But still, now that we are in the next leg of IBC, where the defaulters are not the big guys,
yeah,
but it's now going to be the medium and small guys,
yeah,
I think there are many apprehensions still. And secondly, there are obviously now those conversations going on that IBC is a good final resort to take, but there should be some transitional arrangements in between. For example, if you're going in, this would be a pre-pack, or there should be some sort of a, you know, a mechanism where you don't have to like all the time go to NCLT, because let's face it, NCLT is also overburdened.
That's
right. So, like, given all those things, I mean, I know there are a lot of moving pieces here, but
yeah,
what is your, like, if I ask you, like, what is your headline view on the IBC, its successes, its failures, and where do you think it can improve itself and develop further? How
yeah
do you?
So very broadly, the IBC has definitely been a positive move for the Indian economy. If you think opening a business in India is easy, try closing a business. I mean, it's very difficult even now with IBC.
Right.
It's very difficult to sort of pack up and move on to a different shift. So what's essentially happened is the first round of IBC has pulled into focus the big names and the way these companies were mismanaged and how funds were diverted, etc., etc. So now in the second phase, now that tier 2 companies, so to speak, are under the lens now, we are facing difficulties, and we are seeing these difficulties being faced by NCLTs across India, that they don't have, number one, the expertise to deal with all these matters, number two, the sort of the number of people you need and the headcount to sort of handle the huge volume of these cases, right? So once you moved on from tier 2 to tier 3, this problem is going to be even more amplified. So that's a problem I'm not sure we're ready to face yet. There are still a few systemic inefficiencies in the way the Committee of Creditors operates. There was recently a decision on voting powers. So take for instance, if you look at home buyers were recently given the authority to be part of the Committee of Creditors. So there are steps being taken, but I feel that the vision with which the IBC was started, we're not keeping pace with it, and we're still falling short of our goal there. I think the one way to improve it is to have more benches.
Right.
So
okay,
currently we don't have as many benches of NCLT, and to have some sort of a mechanism in place before you approach the NCLT. Because if you look at it from a legal standpoint, taking somebody to NCLT is like an arm twisting technique. Because
right,
once it goes there, then you're facing the prospect of a liquidation or winding up or the closure of business. People don't want to face that, you know. There may be genuine problems where people are unable to repay loans.
Right.
So some sort of mechanism is required before that in order to ensure or sort of assist people in repaying their loans and getting people back on their feet.
Yeah, no, I sort of agree 100%, and I was reading somewhere as well. I think there's a difference between being financially distressed and economically distressed. In corporate finance, you know, we sort of look at value of firm by saying present value of all future free cash flows, right? If that is less than what the assets of the firm are, then you're like economically distressed. But if you're just leveraged and you're not servicing debt, it's a financial distress. There are ways to manage it. Restructuring. We've sort of, as formal finance, worked in that field, right? What happens is you restructure it, or some guy comes and buys it out, and you sort of try to get it going. But the conflict of interest, like who gets to vote, right? Like creditors get to vote on it, and there's a conflict of interest there, right? It's their personal, it's what they want to get out of taking it to NCLT.
Yes, yes. And there have been instances, I mean, I read it somewhere, I think in a newspaper, that Naresh Goyal himself was planning on floating a proposal to buy back.
Yeah,
NHL,
yeah.
Right?
And we talked
so,
about
so,
it.
It's suddenly everything forgotten, and then we hand over, you know.
But I mean, that's a very interesting point, because like there are two big precedents which got set, right, within the NCLT. One was that obviously a promoter who is going, because of whom the asset has actually dropped down, that promoter shouldn't be allowed to, that's obvious, it took some time to come in. And the second was like to looking at like things like operational creditors, home buyers and all that, right? But I sometimes wonder, are we like, why are we waiting for precedents? You know, in the sense that this story has been written in other countries already, right? I mean, like US has a very, very mature bankruptcy framework. Why do you think that if you look at the entire IBC process, a lot of things have been kind of falling on, you know, as the cases are going through, as those experiences are coming out, as those judgments are coming in, then in the future they get streamlined further. Isn't it a better idea to also iteratively amend the code at regular intervals of time, or am I just like talking out of my...
No, of course, it's a better idea. Right. But one thing that you have to understand is that the judiciary and jurisprudence is a slow-moving animal.
Right.
So one thing we've inherited greatly from the British part of the common law is called precedent, following precedents.
Right.
So one judgment determines how the other judgment would turn out.
Right.
So since Indian law has moved like this, and our judges and administrators at NCLT act like this, it's very difficult to sort of preemptively put certain guidelines in place.
Right.
So which is why we keep saying that India is still a very nascent jurisprudence in terms of bankruptcy law.
Right.
So I believe it's going to take some time, and it's not going to happen preemptively. People may hope that it does. We may take steps. It's not like it hasn't happened. It's happened in case of Competition Commission, for instance.
Yeah.
But I don't foresee that happening in the NCLT at least anytime soon.
But do you think that entire, you know, 180-270 day framework that has, like, do you actually see on ground that resolutions have become quicker? Because we only read about the most high profile cases, right?
Yes. So what the bankruptcy court has been able to do is, at some level, it's been able to put the fear of God in how these processes are run.
Right.
So it's not, these processes aren't continuing endlessly anymore. There's an agenda-driven work that's happening. And the committee of creditors and lenders, etc., are completely on board with this. Even so, there are a few marginal cases where you hear people are still prolonging it and asking for more time. But I believe the NCLTs are strict and they're not really giving that much leeway. So I think we're moving in the right direction. But I think there's still a ways to go.
In terms of holy cows, do you have any view on that?
No.
I just thought I'd push it a bit. But anyways, basically, I think in terms of, I mean, we can kind of, you know, look at now some things a bit more high level. Like as a corporate lawyer, right? Obviously, we looked at IBC, we looked at enforcement of contracts. Are there any issues? Obviously, these are very micro-level issues that we have spoken of in detail. But except that, are there any, like, if you look at the Indian Companies Act, right? Are there some problems that you see which are, like, very obvious for anyone to see which need to be resolved?
Yeah. So one of the prominent concerns around Companies Act is, I would say, minority shareholder protection.
Okay.
Right? In India, most companies, if not all, are completely promoter-driven. They're family-owned, promoter-driven.
Yeah.
And they end up holding majority of the shares.
Right.
But if there is a person who holds like 2% share in a big enterprise, or even like 1% share in a smallish medium enterprise, they don't really have a say, and their vote doesn't really matter. So that entire landscape has to change. It has been changing slowly, but it needs to sort of step on the gas to ensure that the economy is thriving and people feel free to invest in big companies and to pull out whenever they want to pull out of these companies. What ends up happening in a lot of cases is, we call this oppression and mismanagement, right? Where the majority stakeholders have their way because that's how the company's been run, that's how all companies have been run. So there needs to be a change in protecting minority shareholder interest and to ensure that directors operate in a way that is in their fiduciary capacity, that is completely in favor of the company and not in favor of the majority shareholders. Right. So we have brought about these concepts of independent directors who will ensure that the companies are operated. So the operations of the company is strictly above board and by the book.
Right.
However, I feel that is more of a paper tiger and it's still not happening. If you look at the newspaper today, we read about this Amrapali group, this real estate company.
Right.
How funds were completely diverted.
Yeah.
The same thing happened with Ranbaxy, with the two brothers. How funds were completely diverted to another sort of family member. So these things are so we hear about these in the newspaper because these are high, big ticket transactions.
Because so-called independent directors are not independent.
Yeah, they're not really.
How many do we need? 1/3 of the board has to be independent. Is there a rule for minimum threshold?
I think it needs. I'm not entirely certain.
Okay.
But I think one independent director is required.
Okay. Right? That okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. No. Like you said, like these are on paper, right?
Yeah.
I mean, at the end, they're probably just in bed with the promoters, metaphorically speaking,
that's
and trying to just push the same mandate. So. And in sort of the Western world, it is a very, it's take corporate governance as such is a this is corporate governance, right? It's of very critical importance. Like, it makes headlines. Like, it's, and the reason being, like, that independence is key for capital markets, free markets, financial price discovery, efficient stock market. Like, these are all tied together, corporate governance. Like you said, getting in and out of the stock for a minority shareholder should be just as easy as a majority, or should have that optionality. And for that, like, independent directors, like, it's fundamental, right? I mean, that's sort of what...
I think, you know, it's a function of also, you know, like, if you look at a typical, if you look at Sensex, the average free float of a company is 20%.
Yeah, it's right. True.
I mean, and if you look at the promoter shareholding, average is around 70% plus.
Yeah.
Unless these companies are open to takeovers, passive or aggressively, I mean, promoter-driven shareholding won't convert to widely-driven shareholding. And only when it's widely-driven, then, you know, you can actually think of these mechanisms to put come into place.
Today, like, I think Bandhan Bank, I was reading, they have a promoter-driven shareholding of 70%. Now they're saying that they're going to bring it down to 40%.
I mean, that's what happened with Mindtree as well.
In case
of Mindtree, effectively, one of the guys wants to exit. What's wrong with that, right?
Well, Mindtree wasn't promoter-driven.
It wasn't, even though it's like a... being an IT stock, it's kind of more diversified. Even there is a... So, I think, you know, the thing is that the first generation or second generation of promoters, they would have to realize that there is a moment after which they have to professionalize and they have to let go.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, for instance, even Infosys, you know, like, tremendous respect for the company, tremendous respect for Mr. Narayan Murthy, but even he kind of, you know, in between makes creates, you know, now you're in an emeritus position, you can calm down.
Yeah.
And you can, you know, like, you're already a very respected person. So, you know, it's a question of letting go also, right? Well, on that
very, independent,
very,
note.
Very, very philosophical tone. So Sharath, you have done the usual thing. We have discussed about a lot of problems, and we have discussed about a lot of drivers behind those problems. But when it comes to solutions, we are also kind of, you know, taking a middle ground here, because after all, it's a 1 hour podcast.
We can't
really close all the loops here. But it's been a real pleasure, Kushan, to have you here. Hope you enjoyed interacting with both of us. Generally, we just interact with each other.
Yeah.
So.
Absolutely. This is way better than arguing in a court.
Okay, good. That's good. Yeah, no, it was a pleasure, and it's always fun. And it's a sector that interests me a lot without me knowing a lot much. So I know a lot more now. So really appreciate your time.
Great. And so with that, I think we can sign off on today's podcast. Would obviously welcome all our listeners to comment, give your feedback on this new guest series. If anybody wants to come over and talk to us about funky things from the world of business, finance, and anything relevant from a consumer interest perspective, do give us a shout. And do obviously check out Cornelia Chambers and Kushan. He's been very, very kind to give us his time. And yeah, with that, this is Nikhil Arora.
And this is Sharath Tupran.
Signing off.